Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Nearly 200 years ago, Isambard Kingdom Brunel was at the forefront of an infrastructure revolution. The aim was to meet the challenges of his age. But what do we do now in a climate emergency, an ever-changing world? Well, let's go beyond Brunel and discuss how we can shape the region between now and 2050. I'm Christopher Ackland, a civil engineer living and working in the Southwest, and I'll be posing key questions to infrastructure leaders and industry experts throughout this podcast series. Although climate change cuts across all of our episodes, in this edition we'll be focusing exclusively on the role of achieving net zero. From delivering renewable energy to cutting carbon in construction, we'll be exploring how the region's infrastructure can lead the way in decarbonising. Today I'm joined in the studio by Megan Pearce, climate change consultant at the Met Office, Stephen Beggs, director at Curtin's and ICE Southwest carbon representative, Deborah Greaves, Professor of Ocean Engineering and Director of the Coast Laboratory at the University of Plymouth. And joining us online, David Simons, Future Ready Innovation Leader at WSP and SOCEnv's Environmental Professional of the Year 2020. Welcome to all of my guests. I wonder, David, if you might start us off by just explaining to our audience what we mean by net zero and how we've set targets to achieve it.
Yes, hello everybody. So net zero in a nutshell means cutting greenhouse gas emissions to virtually zero. Carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxides, and the like, and then mopping up the balance using either natural sources or mechanical purposes. For companies, for cities, we've got a definition of net zero. That means halving carbon by 2030 and cutting emissions from baseline by at least 90% before reaching for the offset button. And the UK is also well on the way to net zero. It has a net zero plan. And the Committee on Climate Change has set a series of carbon budgets out to 2037 that provides a cost-effective pathway to getting to that net zero by 2050 target that the UK is legally committed to.
And I think it's important, isn't it, to make clear that we aren't aiming for zero emissions full stop. We're just aiming to balance what we emit with what we can be offset or stored. Is that correct?
It's correct, but don't for a moment, though, think that it is not an enormous change in cutting greenhouse gas emissions. It is not just a we will drizzle along at current trajectory reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It is an enormous change. And things like mechanical carbon capture storage and things like tree planting and peatland restoration absolutely have a role, but it is not business as usual.
And as usual, as we start this episode, let's begin with a big question. What does net zero mean for the Southwest? I wonder if I could turn to you first, Deborah.
As David has said, it means a huge change for us all. And it's not just about changing our technology and changing the infrastructure, but it's a change for everybody and how we use the technology and how we use the infrastructure. In my own area, which is particularly in offshore renewable energy, there's a huge opportunity coming up in the Southwest. In that the local Celtic Sea, which is local to us, is being developed for floating offshore wind. And so there's a huge opportunity for us to think about how that infrastructure is going to fit within the Southwest, within the businesses and the opportunities and this infrastructure we have around ports and manufacturing that can help support that development, but in a way that benefits the Southwest and also is done along the lines of net zero and in harmony with nature.
Stephen, you've got a role at ICE Southwest as a carbon champion representative, but clearly you've got a day job as well, and you work for Curtin's as a director. So in terms of net zero in the Southwest, what does that mean to you?
Well, I sit on the committee and I listen in to the debates on all the various aspects that our colleagues are involved with, whether it's marine engineering, weather science, roads, bridges and buildings. And I'm trying to make sure that we're considering carbon as a gender item in all of those fields. Are we making the responsible decisions as we go forward? Are we thinking of these issues that have been mentioned in how we balance our carbon emissions, making sure that we're progressing forwards throughout?
And Megan, I think I'm right in saying that around 70% of global carbon emissions produced every day are linked to infrastructure, the processes needed to create them. And so presumably this is an enormous problem.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's quite interesting when we're talking about what net zero looks like in the Southwest specifically, but actually we're thinking about net zero as the UK as a whole and as a global issue. And I think when we talk about greenhouse gas emissions and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, yes, we can do things in the Southwest, but also this is a global scale problem. So we need to think about how as the Southwest do we contribute? How do we tackle the net zero problem? But then how do we contribute as the Southwest to the UK and then the global picture as well?
I want to pick up on a quote now by Steve Kroski, Deputy Director for Infrastructure and Project Management at the UN. He said, "The challenge is moving away from business as usual." So I suppose the question is, how do we do this at a local level and on the ground, David?
Well, I think it's about making it everybody's opportunity, Chris. For us in WSP, this is about business opportunity, and businesses are motivated by growth. They're motivated by innovation. And we all of us who work in business, we are all people and we're motivated by purpose. And so the title of this series, Beyond Brunel, one of the things that I will talk to our people about is the challenge of net zero is all about giving our people back their Brunel and putting them at the heart of providing the solution and using that as a way to set WSP and our sector apart as being at the heart of providing the solutions. And that's really empowering.
And Megan, we know we've got aims, clear aims to head for net zero by 2050. But I wonder if you can just set the scene for us and give us some of the climate science. You know, how bad is it likely to get and why do we need to act?
So if we think about our climate in the Southwest as it is, we're one of the most exposed locations in the UK. So when you think of risk from wind, we're particularly vulnerable here. If we think about rainfall, for example, it's quite varied actually over the Southwest because we have these sort of plateauing down to the sea level. We have our moorlands. So there's quite a lot of variation in our climate and our infrastructure have different risks. So therefore, when you then look into the future, those risks are changing. We know our climate is changing, but the extent of the risk and what those risks are will vary across the Southwest. They'll vary in temperature, they'll vary for rainfall. And it's important that we take these things into consideration when we're planning new development, but also when we think about the resilience of our current infrastructure.
You mentioned resilience there, and clearly resilience and adaptation are two words which are, you know, often heard of when talking about climate change. And Stephen, and perhaps David, I wonder in terms of day-to-day roles and how we can go about approaching climate change as designers, what is better? Is it resilience or is it adaptation or is it a bit of a mix of both? Stephen, if I could just ask you first.
Well, I think resilience, say, for example, in terms of thermal comfort, as the world is getting hotter and all the rest of it, if we've designed a building, taking that as an example, which is very light thermally, so say a timber frame or a tin shed, it clearly isn't resilient to a rising temperature. Something with thermal mass would be much better, like a church or a cathedral with a big thermal inertia. So maybe when we're doing a concrete frame building, if that's the way we go, then the roof, rather than just put metal sheeting on the roof, take the concrete slab up to the roof as well, so that when the sun's coming down in another 20 years and you've got longer summers, then you've got that thermal control in the top level as well, so people are comfortable there.
And David, can I get your views on that?
Just building off of some great points that Steve has made, I think you absolutely have to think about both resilience and net zero. The two are absolutely together. And if we just focus on the drive to net zero, we ignore the reality that the climate is already changing. So I think a common response that we are seeing in the business is a move to designing flexibly and adaptably, not just in buildings, although that's really, really important, but also in infrastructure as well. So the work that we've done, for example, down at Hulls Bay, down in Poole Harbour, they're really thinking about how we upgrading railway embankments. So we're building in future flexibility so that you can change things easily and lower cost if needs be. Lower cost to start with, lower wastage, lower carbon, a more clever solution by engineering.
The opportunity for creative design that is coming out of the climate change agenda and everything that's with it is immense. And it's almost like a new revolution in the way we design and the constraints that we must put on our work. And that gives members of the ICE and engineers generally a huge opportunity to develop their skills. Because I think the worst thing that can happen is we don't take account of this and we design badly and we build assets that in 5 or 10 years are redundant or derelict and not wanted, not resilient, not adaptable, because we didn't think about this stuff. So for our young engineers at the start of their career, to have this ahead of them is daunting, but really, really exciting as well.
And we can't ignore the fact that we've just been through a period of drought. And this is with the backdrop of the energy crisis, of course, as well. And of course, Deborah, you know, I know much of your work is involving renewables. And what do you think our way forward is in that space?
For renewables, what we specialise in at University of Plymouth and with the Coast Laboratory, we do a lot of work in offshore renewable energy. So we're looking at offshore wind, wave and tidal energy, three different key forms of offshore renewable energy. Offshore wind that we're very familiar with at the moment looks similar to onshore wind. And we have, until very recently, had the largest capacity globally for offshore wind. But those offshore wind farms are all fixed. They're fixed to the seabed, monopiles or jacket structures. And as we go to try to meet the ambitions of the Committee on Climate Change in order to decarbonise our electricity, we need more renewable energy. We need to go and access further resources in offshore. And that means going further offshore and into deeper water. So the new technology that's needed is floating offshore wind structures. And that's new technology. So as with other types of new technology, it needs to be developed, it needs to go through research and innovation into commercialisation, and it needs to have the risks and the uncertainties reduced as it goes through that process and then into commercialisation. But as well as offshore wind, we also need other forms of renewable energy sources, because of course by its very nature renewable energy is intermittent, it's variable, it has different characteristics. So in order to have a resilient energy system, which is renewable, then we need to have a diverse range of sources. So we need offshore wind, we need solar, we need wave energy, and we need tidal stream. And those areas also need to be developed.
And I did notice an omission there, Deborah, perhaps not on purpose, but tidal range was missed off. And is that a key way moving forward?
Absolutely. Tidal range is also a very key technology. There are some particular issues around environmental interaction and impact. But if you look at a tidal range solution, which is a barrage solution, which blocks off an estuary, then that can have significant impact. But there are other tidal range solutions, like, for example, tidal lagoons that have been looked at as well. But I think the point that you made about this being such an exciting area for engineering, I mean, it's absolutely exciting and inspiring area for young people to get into. And I think also the need to, when we're thinking about developing machines that are going to live offshore in our marine environment, which we highly value, and we understand much more about why we should value it so much than we did maybe 20 years ago, then that's a really exciting challenge which needs to bring in collaboration of different disciplines as well. And engineers of the future need to understand more about, or need to make sure they understand about, the environmental interactions, need to work with marine biology specialists. We need to also understand how people are going to use the technologies, and both from the point of view of the end user, but also those who are going to work with the technologies as well, and make sure that they're doing that in a safe way when you're working offshore. That's a key consideration.
And Megan, in terms of extremes and what sort of ceilings we might be dealing with, what are those ceilings? Could you just give us a feel?
We know that extreme temperatures and extreme events in general will become more frequent and more intense. And that is the concern. And it's something that we need to take seriously. For example, if we think about heat waves in summer 2018, by 2050, those could happen every other year. So sort of a 50% increase. And so when we think about development, when we think about infrastructure, we need to ensure that that's what we're preparing for. But there is also opportunities. So if we think about sort of cold events, these may decrease as the temperatures warm. We will still get those rare events. You know, that's not going to disappear completely, but perhaps there are opportunities there where we can capitalise on the less cold events. And in terms of extreme rainfall, for example, we know that we're going to get wetter winters. In summer, it might be drier overall, but we know those intense rainfall events are going to be more intense and more frequent. So again, we are facing different challenges into the future that our infrastructure might not be prepared for, and challenges that we need to think about moving forward as well.
My understanding is that 90% of global economy now has some form of climate goal. But David, are we doing enough at a local level to implement those goals?
The immediate answer is you can always do more. But I think as a glass half full person, I think the UK is seen internationally as a leader in taking action. But I still think that there is just an enormous amount to do. And if we move to just to think about something like transport, transport is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the UK at the moment. Project I've been working very closely with for the past 2 years is working with National Highways on their net zero plan. They've set a commitment, just one of their flagship commitments is that they will be net zero for maintenance and construction of the network by 2040. That's in line with Committee on Climate Change's challenge. That's an enormous challenge, an enormous opportunity for civil engineering and engineering as a whole to be at the heart of delivering that. And yes, there's going to be innovation for construction materials, but that's a massive opportunity and challenge right now for engineers across the region and across the UK to both lead on that and then also, as we are seeing, export that expertise to other countries who are less far advanced than the UK is.
And Stephen, do you think the innovations in construction that we're seeing are keeping pace with these goals? I mean, you know, they're obviously hugely ambitious, the goals, but are we keeping up with those?
Perhaps not. I think we can do a lot with our conventional technologies just by working them harder. But I don't think the innovations are keeping up just yet. For example, we tried to design a hospital the other day in timber, and we went quite a long way down the road. It was for the Welsh government. Their climate change agenda is quite sophisticated, and they really wanted to do this timber hospital. Structurally, we did it, no problem. But we get to the fire, and then we need fire details that are certified by building regs to protect timber in a fire. We're not there yet, because do we put plasterboard around it? Do we let it burn? Do we allow fixings between the plasterboard and the timber, which may melt in the fire, etc., etc.? So whereas we can get some of the things through, we have the paperwork, if you like, if I can put it like that. The paperwork has to catch up so that we can actually certify those structures as safe, etc. That's just one example. I'm sure there are many, but there are areas where the innovative research needs to back up to keep pace with the climate change agenda.
That's a really interesting example, because one of the projects I was looking just before I came on air was a beautiful new timber hospital that our Canadian consultants have designed and has been built in Mississauga, just near Toronto. We need to get much more clever at not reinventing the wheel country to country, but taking best practice from different markets.
Yeah, because in the end, the timber hospital plus plasterboard to meet our regulations has more carbon in it than a concrete hospital. That's where we ended up. So you end up going down some blind alleys trying to do the right thing. So we've got to have a really collaborative approach to getting through this.
And Deborah, in the innovation space and in terms of renewables, is that technology keeping pace with our goals?
A lot of the new projects that have been leased and have won contracts for difference in the recent auction, the ScotWind projects, many of those are for floating offshore wind. That technology is really still at the demonstration stage at the moment. We have the first two commercial projects, demonstration and early commercial projects in Scotland. We have one planned down here in the southwest as well, off the north coast of Cornwall. But yeah, that new floating offshore wind technology is developing very rapidly. So I think we are keeping pace. Just talking about targets and figures, we had with the offshore wind sector deal, I think that was in 2021, they set a target of 30 gigawatts by 2030. Then we had the government's 10-point plan in December 21, I think, and that went up by 10 gigawatts to 40 gigawatts by 2030. And then, of course, we had the energy security strategy, which then upped it to 50 gigawatts of offshore wind, five of those being floating. So we've got these very ambitious targets, and that plus the contracts for difference scheme and the way that's working is bringing the offshore wind industry along quite quickly. We're seeing those developments and we're seeing the cost reduction happening as well. But as I mentioned before, there are other emerging technologies that do need to be developed in order to give us that diverse mix. And we need to keep investing in the research and development in those areas.
And Megan, it seems like there's quite a lot going on to try and future-proof ourselves, if you like, to climate change. But I wonder, are we going to see an acceleration in some of these phenomena that we've been seeing recently?
In terms of what we've seen recently, as I mentioned, these extreme high temperatures that we saw over summer, so 36 degrees Celsius in Bude, if we look at it from a southwest perspective, 40.3 degrees Celsius in Lincolnshire, we will see these types of extreme temperatures more frequently and for longer periods of time. And that is going to cause stress on our ecosystem services, on our infrastructure and across all sectors. So this is an issue that is happening now, and it is something that will continue to happen into the future and more often. And so we need these innovation, we need this engineering, we need these solutions to help us in this situation. I think the other thing is that innovation comes also from our knowledge and from our science. So I feel very fortunate to work at the Met Office and get to speak to a lot of very clever people who sit in the Hadley Centre and do all sorts of interesting science, and innovation happens there. And you mentioned collaboration, and I know that was one of sort of the main pillars of this podcast series. And I think this is an area which is really key, where we need to do better to work together and communicate. We need the scientists who have the knowledge about the climate and how that will change. And we need to bring that knowledge to the people on the ground creating these new technologies and these new engineering solutions. And that collaboration together is going to be crucial in overcoming these challenges, because we can sit here and say, you know, the climate is changing, and, you know, Steve and Deborah can say, oh, we're doing this technology and this innovation. But if those two things aren't going together, then actually we might end up, as you say, with stranded assets or down blind alleys. And there's a lot that we could all be doing to communicate that together faster. And I think actually on that point is this idea of feedback loops. It's something we're really pushing at the Met Office. What science do you need to create your solutions? What science are we doing that we can provide answers to you guys? And that collaboration is going to be key.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
That stranded assets thing is really interesting, because we're really conscious that if we have a building that's running on a 2 or 3 year design cycle, if we're not right up with the state of the art, by the time it's actually built, the tenants aren't going to want to go in it, because they're going to be ahead of the game, because things are moving so fast in public perception of what's an acceptable building to be in a fashionable sense, that people don't want to be in the old one that was just built and delivered to an old spec that wasn't up with the science or not up with the tech,
yeah,
or didn't have bike sheds and showers and this and that so that people can commute more easily. The whole remit of what a building should be.
Yeah, and the innovation of the science to get those answers in terms of what the spec should be is constantly changing. So we're doing some sort of quite advanced stochastic modelling now to try and model these drought scenarios so that the water companies can be more prepared in the future. So we're constantly trying to evolve not only the data we're producing in terms of what you might consider from a raw climate model, you know, the temperature in this location will change by this much in the future. It's being innovative in how we use that data, the data analysis, the processing that we do to get the answers. And before, you know, you might have been designing a reservoir to withstand a 1 in 100 year, a 1 in 200 year drought. And now we're talking about a 1 in 500, 1 in 1,000 year drought. And doing better science is crucial, because we're asking, you know, sectors to invest large amounts of money. So we need to improve our quantification of extremes. We need to improve our quantification of uncertainty so that the investment and the innovation is aligned with the level of change. So you don't build something. I mean, can something be too resilient? That's another question in itself. But so that the investment is aligned with the change. And that's something that will be really important.
The Environment Agency have just finished remodelling the flood levels through the centre of Bristol. And there's an interesting thing coming out there, which is that many of the existing buildings will be underwater in 2080 at their ground floor levels. So how do you address that with your resilient buildings? And where would we build a new building now in a gap in a row of buildings that are all at a lower level? Where do we put the ground floor of that building? Mm. Next to the street or a metre above the street? That's where the science is starting to impact on our engineering designs.
And all of these little things need to come together. You need the innovation in the science, you need the innovation in the technology, and then we need to communicate that to the people who need those answers so that they can do the innovation in the engineering to bring those solutions together. And I think there's lessons to be learned from other countries, but also I think the UK should shout a bit more about what we're doing here, and collaboration, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And I think internationally, it's very important to collaborate, and just across any borders, because where the energy is produced is in one area, but where it's going to be used is in another. So, you know, it can't be a regional thing. It needs to be something that we connect up across boundaries around the country, but also globally as well, both from the point of view of developing innovation and learning from one another, but also making sure that you don't have stranded assets or doubling up on something in close proximity and so on.
Megan, I was just so pleased that you also talked about the communication, because that's just such an important area that sometimes as very intelligent, degree-led people, which many of our people are, we can sometimes think that the science and the facts is enough to drive change. And I think certainly our experience in WSP has been that actually this is a culture change as much as a fact change and a science change. Getting those to our people and then inspiring and challenging them to do their best and to be at the heart of the solution. There's no rules, there's no science that gets in the way of that. That's just about really giving them the latitude and the inspiration, as well as some of the rules which sometimes engineering through its codes is very dominated by.
And as we go forward, we know that there's going to be increased demand on energy, we're installing new infrastructure, our infrastructure is changing. Do you think that we are going to require infrastructure providers and facilitators to think about more about systems as a whole, i.e. if we're installing new EV charging points, should those installers and facilitators of those charging points talk to the energy suppliers in more of a joined up approach? And equally, should collaboration take a much broader perspective? Stephen, get your views on this for me.
Well, the answer has to be yes, but there's some really difficult stuff in that. I mean, if, for example, you want to put EV charging points in, then the scale of the substation that you need to provide the power for fast charging is immense. So should we, can we be providing larger power supplies to, for example, a motorway service station to deliver that? Or is it more important to direct that power towards the new housing estate? So you're going to have some quite difficult choices in order to navigate how we deliver some of these key infrastructure feeds, the energy feeds, etc.
And Deborah, in your line of work, presumably you're having to bid for funding. I wonder, what are the consequences of underfunding our decarbonisation efforts?
Clearly, underfunding would have severe implications. I mean, I think, as everyone said, there's a huge amount that needs to be done, and over a very short timescale, really. So funding is important. And of course, there's particular schemes of funding that we've lost recently. So we need to think about how those can be reintroduced. Talking about European funding, of course. And one of the things that we've done very successfully at Plymouth within the Coast Lab is to access that type of funding in order to support and to work with SMEs and small businesses in order to help them to develop their ideas for new innovation. And, you know, we've been able to provide pre-funded access to our facilities and our expertise at the university in order to work with those companies and help them. And that's a really key part of the support that you need to give for research and development and innovation development, because it's very difficult for small businesses to be able to have access to that kind of facility. So funding's important and support, but I think behind all of that, it's also public support is also very important. So engaging with the public and making sure that you're having that dialogue and that conversation, because it doesn't matter how clever your engineering solution is, if it's not going to be adopted and used in the way it's designed, then it's not really going to be very helpful. So I think funding, but also funding to make sure that we're always talking about what we're doing and communicating and bringing people along with it. Because if the funding's coming through government, then that needs to be driven by public will.
There is absolutely no way that government can fund in its entirety the net zero transition. The cost is just enormous. So the role of government is to provide the policy. The role of government is to provide the framework for great innovation and the like, and to set out its priorities. But as we're seeing, for example, in the electric vehicle charging networks that are being installed now, for example, in Devon, that's private sector that is financing that. And the innovation in low carbon materials from asphalt to cements to steel, government's role is to provide the framework, but the companies that make the asphalt, the cement and the steel are very, very large companies. They need to be innovating in this area within the framework that exists.
David, that's a really good point. And what I'm starting to see, particularly over the last couple of years, is that some of these private companies you've just been talking about, they have to get their funding from somewhere. Say, for example, a pension fund who's above them in the food chain, if you like. And those pension funds now want to be seen by their shareholders as being green. So the big private companies wanting to make their money can make more money by accessing green funding. And that's coming through those routes. So they're being encouraged to develop green policies so they can access that funding more easily, which seems to be, to me, a win-win.
it's probably not fair to be discussing net zero without also mentioning biodiversity. And David, I wonder if you could take us through what biodiversity means and how this relates to the UK government's 25-year environment plan.
Yes, for sure. So we've spent a lot of time talking about the climate emergency and net zero and resilience. But of course, net zero doesn't happen in isolation. And increasingly, we're aware that the biodiversity of the UK, indeed the world, has declined enormously over the past 40 to 50 years. And so as part of the Environment Act, the government's 25-year environment plan, there are also some really bold commitments to increase biodiversity and at least halt the decline. And so that becomes more and more of a central priority through things such as biodiversity net gain, which we will see through the UK planning system, that go to the heart of the schemes that we are designing, rather than historically being a little bit of a byproduct of the pure infrastructure facility with environmental and biodiversity aspects considered as an afterthought.
And Stephen, should more nature-based solutions play a greater role in delivering South West infrastructure?
Yes, I think so. And I think you can see it. If you drive through a new housing development now, you can see a lot of the surface water managed on the surface, rather than in buried underground tanks, for example. And we're starting to see it by the side of the roads. You see areas just left to return to nature or be part of a swale solution or surface managed water or something like that. And maybe 10 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to see any of that. It would have been all paved, there'd have been tanks, there'd have been pipes leading the water off-site. But now people are dealing with them on-site, trying to deal with their own, if you like, the mess they've made. They're going to deal with it locally, within the red line of that development. Deal with your emissions, deal with your waste, deal with your water arising, and just deal with it, rather than offsetting it onto somebody else.
And in terms of the climate, Megan, that's going to have an effect on our biodiversity, isn't it? And, you know, nature, flora, fauna, as we go forward.
I personally really like seeing all these new nature-based solutions. They make our towns and cities much more attractive. And in terms of public support, like Deborah was mentioning, that's extremely important that these solutions, we do get the buy-in from the public. From a climate perspective, there are so many opportunities where nature-based solutions can support adaptation and resilience. But again, it's another example of where it has to be done with some thought in terms of that ecology and that biodiversity, its own resilience and vulnerability. If we think about how the climate might change in the future, is the species of grass, is the species of trees we're planting, are they going to be resilient in that location in the future? And therefore, is that nature-based solution going to be as effective in a future climate? So it's a really exciting opportunity to use nature. But again, as with all of these solutions, is there will always be some form of climate consideration in terms of the opportunity, but also the risk as well.
And we focused a lot on resilience in the climate and nature space, but obviously we can't ignore the fact that infrastructure is inherently designed around people. And David, I'm interested in getting your thoughts on how we're designed for people in terms of social needs, social value, health, well-being, and so on.
I think that's a great topic for engineers to look at. We're doing some research at the moment as part of our Future Ready programme that's identified that the number of people who say that they suffer from neurodiversity has doubled in the last 10 years. So how we can design streets and buildings that work for the neurodiverse as much as those who have physical difficulties as well. But I think also, if you don't mind me broadening your question a bit, Chris, I think this is also about who we are as people, as engineers as well. This is about positioning engineering and engineers at the heart of the net zero solution. So it becomes a really attractive career for our young people to want to pursue. And it's also the challenge for us as a profession to find our voice and to be at the heart of providing the net zero solution, rather than sometimes in the past that engineering, we have forgotten our Brunel a little bit, and we are a bit passive, and we are a bit subservient in project teams. And you know what? That has to change if we're going to do our profession justice and to reposition and put engineers with a voice absolutely at the heart of the creation of a prosperous, resilient, net zero, reliable economy that is thriving. And that's the opportunity for us all.
David, I completely agree with that. In an age of plenty, maybe like our parents have lived through, for example, where you can just basically have what you want, build what you want, build it taller, build it bigger, then you don't have to have such skilled people delivering it, because you just get out a catalogue, I'll have one of those. But now that we have these huge constraints on us, and we don't have the land of plenty that we're living in anymore, and we've got to make these adjustments to our freedoms and to what we can build, then surely what you need are problem solvers and collaborators in the middle of that. It's what Megan was saying about the science and the engineering linking up. And engineers are perfectly placed. We are, by our nature, problem solvers, so we need to get on with it.
But the people that are solving the problem need to be as diverse as the people that need to use the solution that we design. And so there's another important thing here, which is about the workforce, inspiring young people so that we have a much more representative industry.
Indeed.
OK, we'd like to end each episode with some real-life inspiration. I'll therefore ask each of our guests to draw an example of infrastructure or something contributing to infrastructure in the Southwest that's working really well and worth shouting about. Megan.
I work at the Met Office, so that's not an example of infrastructure, but I think it's an example of an organisation situated in the Southwest, which brings a lot of expertise and knowledge to the area. And my hope is that we can do better in our collaboration in the region to share that knowledge and expertise towards some of these solutions that we've been talking about today. From a sort of a more personal perspective, something that I've enjoyed seeing develop over the last few years is the rail network into the Southwest is fairly limited in the sense of, you know, our one route in and out. And quite infamously at Dawlish in February 2014, a great storm washed that part of the railway into the sea. And that caused massive amount of disruption locally, disrupting sort of our transport and network, and also sort of the cost of investment to rebuild that railway. And over the years, it's been quite exciting to see the development of the seawall that they've been building and the infrastructure they've been putting in place since to safeguard that network for us. So the new seawall is now going to be 8 metres. So currently it's only 3.8, quite a substantial increase in height. And it's been really impressive over the years to see that infrastructure going in. It's quite a feat of engineering. Yeah, that for me personally, getting to go on the train and see that feat of engineering is really exciting.
Fantastic. And Deborah?
Based at the university, we have our Coast Laboratory, where we've been supporting the development of offshore renewables for 10 years now. We're about to celebrate our 10-year anniversary. And we've recently had investment in a new wind generation and measurement facility, so that's going to help us do more work with floating offshore wind. So I think the big excitement there is around the development of floating offshore wind in the Southwest, as I said, particularly within the Celtic Sea. And the first demonstration project we'll see there is the Twin Hub project, which is going to be connected into the Wave Hub cable off the north coast of Hale. And I think that's a very exciting opportunity that we're going to see over the next few years. But the wider opportunity is for a supply chain and other development opportunities for the Southwest to support those new technologies.
Brilliant. And David, what are we doing well in the Southwest?
I had the pleasure this summer of cycling the 16-mile ex-estuary trail that is a wonderful piece of infrastructure that connects Exeter along Devon's south coast. It's in a beautiful environment, as you would expect, of course, for Devon. There's a lot of timber involved in with it. And it, over the time that it's been built, it's seen a increase in cycling trips in that area by about 90%. And so for me, that's just a classic example of, I'd love us to have a lot more ex-estuary trails across the country. It's a beautiful piece of design and it's in a wonderful area.
And Stephen?
Well, compared to my colleagues, this is a very urban example. One of our projects is to consider the future of a large department store in the centre of Bristol, and it's no longer required as such. And we've got to decide with our developer client whether to take it down and rebuild it or keep it. So we measure the carbon in all our projects now, so we can make a quantitative assessment and use data to decide the future, not just, oh, it must be right to keep the building. So we've looked at the numbers and two options, retain and modify it, or demolish it, keep the foundations and put a new frame on top. And the data is really interesting. So if you keep it and modify it, with some works, like making a light well through the middle or something like that, then the total amount of carbon at construction stage is about 2,000 tonnes. Really big numbers, 200 times my annual carbon impact to modify that building and keep it. But then when we're heating it and operating it, it won't be brilliant because it's still an old building. It's just been sort of redressed and reprovided with a plant room, perhaps not quite in the best place, and the walls aren't quite what we'd want. But it works. So we rebuild it, 2,000 tonnes, and then we heat it not particularly well. And after, let's say, 8 years in 2030, it's got about 5,000 tonnes of carbon impact. Or we knock it down and start again. And at the point of construction, that's 4,000 tonnes. But then we can heat it really efficiently because it's a modern building, etc., etc. And guess what? The carbon impact total in 2030, broadly similar. But the interesting thing is that the new build overtakes that then for all future years because it's being heated and cooled much more efficiently. So you've got a really interesting dilemma here. Do you keep it for the initial carbon saving now in a climate emergency because we can't afford anything more than the absolute minimum carbon? Or do you increase your carbon now, which we can't really afford, to get a longer term payback? And we've been through all this with the client developer, and he's fascinated by it because he's never heard this discussion before. And on his first meeting with the council, he took this data to have the debate with the council. So the excitement in the team that we're working with new conversations here in front of a decision-making body is really good at the moment. It's exciting. It's motivating our engineers to try and do the right thing. And we'll wait and see how it turns out.
Fantastic. That sounds brilliant. Thank you very much, Stephen. And with that, we'll end. Thanks to our guests, Stephen Beggs, Deborah Greaves, Megan Pierce, and David Simons. You can find out more information about the Beyond Brunel podcast series and related research projects at southwestinfrastructurepartnership.co.uk. This podcast is supported by the Institution of Civil Engineers, Southwest.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.